Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and this is Literary Viewpoints, and this is a very special show, a one and only time it ever did a show in July. Patrick Bush's career as a Navy SEAL should have ended after parachuting accident nearly crippled him, but overcoming adversity, even an injury as serious as a broken hip, was nothing new to him. When I read this story, I had to get a box of tissues, people, because it was so heartwarming and so encouraging. So anybody that has ever gone through anything, once you read this, you'll be able to go. This is a true inspiration. So I would like to welcome Patrick Bisher and John Land, co-author of No Surrender. Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for having us.
Doing good, Fran. And we have to make sure we pronounce Patrick's name Bisher,
Bisher.
I've made
okay,
that mistake
so
for
I wasn't
the first
sure.
Well, I made that mistake for the first 3 months we were working together on the book until he finally corrected me. Made me feel a little bit stupid, but that's
sure
nothing new in my
life.
I
wasn't sure if it was a long guy or a short guy. That's my reading credentials coming through. I said, well, wait a minute. Is this long or short? Okay. I sure got it.
Perfectly
fine. So, John.
Now, for the people that don't know me, they'll pronounce it Bisher, but everyone who knows me knows it's Bisher, so now you know and we're friends. I appreciate that.
That's good. Okay, because I did that to Joseph Finder, and I thought it was Finder, and he didn't like that either. I learned. And there are people on my Facebook
wall. We should sell
wall
as many books
listening
as Joe Finder.
He's still Finder. Yeah, he said Finder. That's what he said. There are people that are listening on my Facebook wall. People are commenting. Oh, this is very nice. Getting popular here. So how did you two guys connect to create this memoir? And why did you decide to share this story with everyone?
Why don't I take the first part of that that question, and
okay,
Patrick can take the second.
Okay.
I was
okay
connected with Patrick by a fellow SEAL, someone that's very closely associated with the SEALs, named Jeff Wilson, who's a fellow member of our writers of the Writers Organization, International Thriller Writers. That's how I met Jeff and a number of other Navy SEALs. And all I knew was that he had written a book, nonfiction, some form of memoir, and he was looking for a writer to help steer him in the right direction, whether toward a publisher or work with him to get the book in better condition. And since I had experience with that, Jeff Wilson was aware that I had experience with a couple other books in the narrative nonfiction format. You know, I contacted Patrick about we spoke for the first time maybe a day later, and he sent me what he had written, which was pretty much what you see in the book, subject to a little of my customary polish. And you know, I would say it has been a great experience.
That is
yes
great. Well, this is a great book. So, Patrick, how come you decided to share this story? And within this book, we learn about how you felt when you were told that you would never walk again. And at that moment, you decided that was never going to happen.
Well, I did want the reader. I wanted people and everyone who's gone through circumstances that I went through to be able to have something to go to lean on, and to inspire them, to motivate them, but to also let them see that just because someone tells you something doesn't mean that you have to accept that as truth.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it's very painful and sometimes you feel like your back's against the wall and there's nowhere to go, that you can still persevere through that. So the reason why I put this in a book is because I believe in my heart that I can reach out to people and help them in the best way with this book, because I've been able to share my story and share my testimony with other people, and I've got a lot of positive feedback. So it was just the next step to what I'm trying to do, and to serve the community, to serve the nation, and to keep pressing forward.
Well, you certainly did, and you inspired me, because I won't even begin to tell you what I've been going through. And every time I think about it, I say, well, if Patrick could get through that, I can get through this. It's going to be fine. And you're right. You don't have to believe what everybody tells you, because that's a fact, too. I agree with you. So, Patrick, how did you? What kind of support did you get when you finally found out? Your family, how did they react to all of this? And how did John? How did you put those words in the book?
When they found out about my hip condition?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. When they found out that you had a problem, how did they react to your news, and how did they support you?
Well, they were I won't say devastated, but the mood was not positive by any means. I mean, it's another setback to our family, and they wanted to support me, but they also felt they felt kind of wronged. It was just another thing that our family had to overcome, and the mood was not good.
When I look at it, I think about what I write about, what I've written about for 40-plus books are heroes. And some of the heroes that I write about are out there in front of everyone. Their action, I make them up so they can do whatever I want. They have the capabilities to do whatever I ask them to do. But writing a story about a real-life American hero, who not only was a decorated veteran of the SEALs, but also had overcome so much adversity, that's what attracted me to the material. That's what, when I saw this, what I saw. How did Patrick get from the boy who was told he was never going to walk again, who spent over a year in a cast up to his hip for a few months, but also in leg braces, on crutches. To me, if you want to start defining what makes a hero, it's overcoming obstacles. It's easy if you have a straight line to your goal. That doesn't make you a hero. When you have a jagged line full of dips and darts and ups and downs in your goal, that's when you're talking about true heroism. And by the same token, when you talk about Patrick's family, in all stories that I write in fiction, there are quiet heroes, unassuming heroes, people who don't look to be heroes but just do the right thing. And I always come back to that phrase, Fran, in my life to describe people who I most admire, people who do the right thing. And I think when you look at what Patrick's family did as the unspoken, selfless heroes who allowed him to become a real American hero, that defines them perfectly. And that's another thing that attracted me to the story, because I don't think any greatness happens in a vacuum. I think it's based on the people you're exposed to in your life, the people who help you, the people who guide you. And Patrick had a lot of those in his life. He had a lot of disappointment and as I said, adversity. That when I read the book today, I'm still struck by, in addition to the physical obstacles he had to overcome, the emotional obstacles and just through his teenage years, what are supposed to be carefree, what are supposed to be, things you look back on and all you have are memories of proms and stuff like that. That wasn't the case for him. And the Patrick Beischer of then and the Patrick Beischer of now are a testament to the fact that he had a goal, he had a vision, and nothing was going to stop him from achieving it. But again, there was help along the way, because nobody succeeds without some kind of help.
Right. And I just wanted to add on top of that, I don't think that I'm a hero by any means. I'm just a regular person, just like everyone else, and I just happened to basically stumble upon everything, and I found a way to get through it. And so you keep saying hero, and I don't associate myself with that. I've definitely served with some amazing people and some heroes in my life, and I'm just blessed to be able to be a part of that. And I also wanted to just add on top of that the unspoken heroes, the people that are always behind the scenes helping out, they're amazing people. My family really supported me, and everything that I did, even if they doubted me. They doubted my abilities. They still supported me, which was comforting.
That's amazing. This prologue that you wrote was really set the stage for what happened in the past. How did it come you decided to include that first so that we got the idea that you were going to succeed at the beginning?
Well, I did want, me and John talked about this for a little bit, and mm-hmm. we wanted to go chronologically with the book. However, I wanted people to know the outcome. Like, I was able to serve in a capacity that I wanted to serve mm-hmm. in, and I was able to accomplish my goals, but I wanted to set it up so that you knew it was a success and it just wasn't another story. So putting the prologue in there and serving with the heroes that I served with was just to set you up and your mind up to let you know that things are possible. And even if the roads are rocky and even if the path is not the way that you choose, that you can still persevere through showing grit and showing true mm-hmm. tenacity and what you want to do and how you want to overcome. Because you can either choose to become a victim of your circumstances mm-hmm. in your life, or you can choose to have a warrior's mentality. And so that kind of set that up at the very beginning.
I felt it throughout the book, and I could feel your anger, you know, your frustration, and I could feel that you weren't going to give up until you got what you wanted. Seriously. And now that's what makes other people that read the book, including myself, know that no matter what you can go through, you're going to get there if you just don't
right.
fall back and give up on yourself. And I've been told that many times.
Right.
You know, you don't give up on anything. You can't. So Dr. Robert Hessinger was the doctor. And did you agree with everything that he did and his solutions? But he taught you how to move and sit up, but the bathroom scene was too much. When you tried to go to the bathroom by yourself and you got there and come back, I said, my God, he's going to do anything he wants. So how do you feel about this doctor?
The doctor's amazing. Dr. Hensinger.
Yeah.
He is by far the most renowned doctor in the pediatrics for that specific mm-hmm. disease. And when I was going through, it was still... medicine is always changing. So he did the best with what he had, and I was sort of his first real success story about being able to come back from that type of problem, that type of disease. And he wanted my best interest. He had my best interest in mind. But that meant free from pain and free from the activities that would cause me harm, and I didn't want that. I was willing to go through pain and hard circumstances to get what I wanted. So our wants were different, but the way that he handled me and the way that he showed me how to do the things that I should do, he did a great job. He was a phenomenal doctor. Yeah.
That's amazing. That sounds amazing. But how did you feel when you first heard that this was going to happen? What was your first reaction? I mean, you're 9 years old and somebody's
denial.
I'm going to put leg braces on you. You're going to have blisters. You're going to have problems. And oh my God! So what was your first reaction? Like, you got to be kidding me?
Right. Yeah. It was no. You know, it was denial. Like, you're wrong. I'm going to get up here and I'm going to walk out of here just like I came in here. And for a young kid, you don't want to hear that. And so I obviously struggled with the reasons behind it. It wasn't until later did I know why those leg braces were put on me, because they were trying to help me. They were trying to heal me by any means necessary. So my initial reaction was, yeah, right. You don't know what you're talking about. And so... Yeah, a doctor telling a 9-year-old mind, that's what you're going to get probably every time, no matter what the case is.
So So, John, how did you decide what to put in the book? Because the next part is that Patrick decides that he was going to walk, run, become an athlete, and his brother. I mean, too bad he didn't come on the show, too. That was amazing. So, John, how did you decide how to write that and what to put in the book? I mean,
you know,
there's so much
in
there, and that's why my review is huge.
That's the collaborative process. That's the nature. To Patrick's credit, everything you read in No Surrender was handed to me in a different form that we needed to polish and work on and turn and find a story and find a message and find the message was there. It wasn't always coming out as clearly as it needed to. So I was more of a grunt. In this case, in the sense that I was taking, I was taking a house and adding the finish work. I was adding, you know, the design. I was furnishing it, but the structure, 95% of what was going to make this great and stand on its own was already there. And what I found is, and here's what I kept coming back to. What Patrick just said about denial and about being told, having that doctor come into the room and describe what your life is going to be like for the next 6 months to a year, we don't want to hear that. And I found that in a microcosm, to be in the micro, to be in the macro, what so many people my own age have faced these last few years. When you look at disappointments in not just my industry, the publishing industry, and in the evolution or de-evolution, people losing their jobs in their 50s and 60s, people losing their livelihoods, people who find themselves one day going into work and the next day finding out everything, they've lost everything that they had relied on and were looking forward to. And I think their reaction is often the same as what 9-year-old Patrick's reaction was when the doctor delivered the news to him. And when those kind of things happen, there aren't a lot of places to turn to. There aren't a lot of ways to find comfort and to find the way out of what I would call the darkness. So what really appealed to me and the theme that I saw, and Patrick already, you know, he just said this in different words, this is kind of a guidepost. This is kind of, you know, a roadmap for people who have obstacles in front of them and have adversity in front of them and are faced every day with the issues in their own life that they have to overcome. You read this book and it changes your perspective on those kind of things. And I think the primary reason for this and the primary thing that I got from day one of our first conversation was when you read No Surrender, when you read Patrick's story, you realize it can be done. That as bad as things seem in that moment when the world comes crashing down and you think you've lost it all or at least a great portion of it, there is hope out there. Now, how people find that hope, how they get to that road, everybody finds it a different way. I think with Patrick, it was his faith. It was finding God. It was this moment when he realized, you know, I'm putting words into his mouth, but it's in the book. The moment when he realized he couldn't do it alone, and maybe, you know, he and I have talked about that, but never in a forum like this, because if you try to bear your burden alone, it's going to be a much heavier lift than if you have support from either, you know, from your faith or your friends or your family, which of course is basically the subtitle of the book, which I think says it all, you know, faith, family, and finding your way.
I agree with you. No Surrender just says it all, and you're not going to give up no matter what. And like I said, it's been an inspiration to me, that's for sure. So even as a teen, you had kids that were picking on you in school, and you didn't put up with it, and you fought back. And every time somebody picked on you and you fought back, I said, yeah, that's great. So you never gave up. So what message would you want to give young people that, you know, might be facing this kind of problem? Or any kind of problem like that. And how did you deal with the bullies in school? Because as an educator, I didn't allow it, and no one ever got away with it.
Well, so there's two sides. I mean, there's the kids that are going through it and that are being picked on, and then there's those that are, you know, picking on other kids. And so for the kids that are the victim in the situation, that they can choose to let that person, you know, dictate their mood, their life, or they can choose to not let them. I mean, it all boils down to a choice. But also the kids that are doing the picking on, they're hurting as well in some form of another. Maybe it's their home life. So for kids that are getting picked on, I mean, they have to challenge themselves mentally to not let a bully, you know, take over their life, but that they can find a place to belong to with other people. You don't have to let someone else outside of you know, your friends or your circle to ruin your life or ruin your mood just because they're a bully, but that, and understand that something is actually wrong with them and they're lashing out to you because it's happening to them also. And it's a bigger understanding, but for small kids, for little kids, for people that are dealing with problems, even getting picked on like in the workplace or something like that, it doesn't have to be just kids, but that they can go somewhere else, they can push forward, they do not have to be that victim, they can choose to keep pushing forward, even though they're getting picked on. And, you know, like I did when I was in my braces, you have to realize that when you get called a name, it does hurt. And, you know, the old saying, sticks and stones will break my bones, words hurt, and they'll stick with you for a long time if you let them. But you do not have to be what other people are telling you that you are. And if you're intelligent, if you're a good kid and you're a bookworm and people are teasing you about that, then, you know, I would say good on you to be a bookworm. They don't realize it, but you're going to be successful because you're passionate about something. Or if you're in a wheelchair and you can't get out of it, there's advantages to that also. You do not have to be unsuccessful. You do not have to be that victim in your life just because someone is picking on you. They don't deserve you. They don't deserve your time. And there's other things that you can do in your life to be who you want to be, but the road will be rocky and you'll have to figure it out. And sometimes it will be on your own, but know that you will be if you keep going and you do not give up.
I totally agree with you. And as an educator, when I found that bullies back down very fast, especially when a little girl that's 5 feet tall like me is a bigger one, and got the point
right.
got the point across. I was the dean. Nobody messed with the girl, and we sort of developed something called peer mediation, where they could actually talk it out rather than fight it out. And it does work when you talk it out. Bullies realize that they're just insecure and they need to feel big, so they pick on somebody that they think is smaller. So the purpose of the story is, what did you decide that you wanted to become a Navy SEAL? And when did you decide to sign up? What was the deciding factor? And then John had to put this into words. That was exciting. So I'm saying, yeah, I'm finally getting to see what people go through when they decide to go through the BUDS program. So what made you decide to do that?
Well, so the first initial decision for me was that I needed another goal. I needed another notch on my belt to prove people wrong in the world about what I could or couldn't do. Because in my mind, I was always that Tiny Tim walking around, and people always viewed me that way. And so for me, even though I had a lot of issues, I still wanted to prove the world wrong and find a sense of purpose in that process. So for me, it was sort of selfish at the beginning, you know, to go in there and to be the best and to be the awesome. Like, no one knew what a Navy SEAL was at that time, really. And And I was like, I wanted to be a ninja and a G.I. Joe. So what can you give me? And so they said, this is the hardest thing. You know, only about 20% make it through. And I said, done. Like, give me that. I needed something to conquer. But to add on to that, and I'll let John talk about the story a little bit, but mm-hmm. I just wanted to touch on what happened in the process. Mm-hmm. The victim mentality that I had, that I carried with me to try to just prove everybody wrong and to just, you know, woe is me, it changed because what I found in that was a brotherhood. What I found in that was personal responsibility, and that people were relying on me to get a job done, and it came more about the team. It came more about the others around me and what I could do to help them. So that really transformed my mindset into that warrior mentality, or that positive mm-hmm. mindset, and it made me a better human being. And so what I wanted to do was prove people wrong and try to, you know, become the best at something. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, what I found is how much I can serve and how successful I would be is, like, determined on whether I could live up to my teammates and help them out and help them be successful. So there's, you know, it went from one thing to the other, and that the SEAL teams helped me figure out how to become a man and how to take ownership of, you know, being me as opposed to what I thought I wanted.
You know, for me, when I think of what this story is at its core, at its heart, mm-hmm. what No Surrender purports to be, there's a wonderful allusion in the book to something that Marcus Luttrell, the hero of Lone Survivor, played by Mark Wahlberg in the movie, but Marcus Luttrell's a hell of a guy even before Mark Wahlberg played him in the movie. You know, a well-known Navy SEAL who was stuck badly wounded on a mountain in Afghanistan after a mission hadn't gone as planned. And in the book, Patrick describes how, with a broken back and broken bones,
mm-hmm.
he had to get down the mountain. An impossible task. So he didn't think about getting down the entire mountain at once. He threw a stone in front of him, and he crawled to that stone. And then he picked the stone up, and he threw it again. And then he crawled to the stone. And who knows how many times he had to throw that stone until he finally got down off the mountain. But that was a metaphor. That was an image that stuck with me. And you mentioned the crawling mm-hmm. to the bathroom scene when mm-hmm. Patrick was 9 years old and in a huge cast and basically living downstairs because he couldn't get upstairs. And, you know, mm-hmm. he had to go to the bathroom and he had dropped the bell that he used to ring to call his mother. So, you know, he had to do it on his own. And it was, you know, you have this metaphor for what he was trying to do in that moment. But to me, a lot of this book is a lot of No Surrender is scenes and sequences that, from a symbolic standpoint, are like Marcus Luttrell, Lone Survivor, throwing the stone and crawling to get as far as he could at that time before he threw the stone again. And it's all about being the underdog. And what mm-hmm. makes this book special is it's easy to write about underdogs in fiction that we all want to root for because of all they've overcome, but the simple fact is that none of it ever happened because it's a novel, because it's fiction. But to have the opportunity to write about an underdog, you know, who had all these obstacles in his way.
Mm.
Another scene that I love in this book that I think typifies the message of the book and the character of the person who wrote it, that being Patrick, not me, is a scene when a friend of Patrick's is being beaten up by mm-hmm. a boy about 30, 40 pounds heavier than Patrick and 2 years older. I think a sixth grader instead of a fourth grader, or a fifth grader instead of a third grader.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big age difference when you're 9 years old, 8 years old, 7 years old. And Patrick you know, there's probably a lot of kids, there's 30, 40 kids in a circle watching this happen or witnessing it, but Patrick jumped in, and he saved his friend. But what I love about that scene is, after Patrick saved his friend, his brother comes riding to the rescue like a scene out of the Old West on his bicycle, and his brother saves Patrick. And I think the message to that is, you know, if and this is what I would like the message to be, that if you do the right thing for others, there will be others who do the right thing for you.
Yeah.
Now, we've never talked about it in those words before, but I think that when you look at what Patrick achieved to become a Navy SEAL, by the nature of what he did as a Navy SEAL and what he's done at since not leaving the active SEALs, and I stress the word active, by becoming a mentor, you know, to prospective SEALs, working with the Navy in that regard, you know, working on training, working on new methods. To me, now he's doing for others what, in a metaphorical sense anyway, what his brother did for him when his brother rescued him in that fight after he had rescued somebody else. So there's a wonderful kind of symmetry to this story of how, you know, life doesn't unfold in three acts, but this book, this story, and it's not like Patrick's old. I mean, like, I'm old. You know.
No, shush.
Yeah, right, there you go. But it's so nice when you have, when art occasionally imitates real life and gives you this beautiful story in three acts, a beginning, a middle. We don't want to call it really an end, though, because it's still going on. You know, we still have a lot more. You know, there's a sequel in there somewhere. I just don't know where yet.
Oh, come on.
That's what I figured. I was going to throw that in afterwards. You knew I was going to say that. So, Patrick, tell us about Coach Ingalls and about the Buds program. I had to hold my breath when you were doing the underwater demolition training, literally. Because for me, like, forget that. I would never be able to do that. I mean, water, you know. So how did you manage that? That must have been tough.
Well, Coach Ingalls was a former coach of mine in high school.
Yeah.
Do you want me to talk about him, or do you want to talk about Buds?
Whichever you want.
Okay. All right. Well, Coach Ingalls, he was the head varsity coach of the basketball team that I was at, and we had differences of opinions, and he was a leader, he was a good man, he was a teacher, but my personality and his personality clashed when it came onto the basketball court, and basketball was my first love and my passion at the time because I wanted to be like my older brother. And so I took the same path that he did. But in the process of trying to be the best that I could be, I felt like I was being blocked by this coach. And he didn't see eye to eye. He was old school. He wanted three passes before I would shoot the ball, or he didn't want me to throw a behind-the-back pass. And what I wanted to do was entertain the crowd and win the game at the same time. And so I struggled with finding a purpose in that group, and we had a falling out, and it ended badly, and I carried that burden with me for a while, and so that actually I had some bottled up anger, which helped me in Buds because of all the situations that I'd been through, and going through Buds training. A lot of people have talked about it in the past, and a lot of different radio shows and books and even a television series. So you can find a lot on that training, but it's very grueling. It's very hard, and you're in a lot of pain every day. You're cold, you're wet, and you're miserable. And you have sand everywhere in your body and in places that you didn't know that you could have sand. So it's bad, you know, and it's supposed to be bad because you're trying to weed out the people that do not want to be there, and they can ring the bell and they can quit at any time. It's a voluntary service. And I didn't want to quit. I never wanted to quit anything, ever. And that, so that was a motivation. But the whole time at Bud's was a very good learning process for me to no longer be the boy or, you know, the 18-year-old man that I thought I was, or 20-something at the time that I thought I was. But it was an eye-opening experience for me that you can do anything that you set your mind to, but you have to be 100% committed. You can't be motivated, because motivation comes and goes. It in peaks and valleys, and then when you're at your lowest point, the instructor staff there will find that and eliminate you, so to speak. And so I learned a lot through that process, and it was the hardest thing that I'd ever gone through at that point in my life, besides the physical pain.
It was very inspirational. I felt like I was going through it with you while I was reading it.
Good, good. I'm glad. That's what I tried to do.
Yeah, you succeeded. So what would you say was your most paramount event or thing that happened the most in Iraq? What would you say about your time in Iraq? What would you most remember the most when you were there? And, John, how did you put that in words? Because I felt like I was there with you guys the whole time.
Well, I would say that the thing that I'll remember the most is the guys that I was with, the people that I served with in all capacities, Army, Air Force, partner forces, everyone that was a part of that task and was a part of the mission. I will remember them and the sacrifices that they made for the cause to, you know, defend our homeland and defend freedom and keep evil from doing evil things. And there are certain memories that I'll hold on to because, like I said before, I was not the greatest. I was not the best. I was not the strongest or the fastest or the smartest.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to work my absolute hardest every day just so I could, be with them. And so I will always remember those guys that I served with because they're so selfless and so passionate, so giving. And the picture that people paint about a hero is a lot different than what you see every day because they're going through real life struggles. I mean, they have marriages, they have kids, they have everything that we have, but they're in a wartime scenario, so that all gets it is exposed, and everyone's living together, everyone's there together. So I will always remember the sacrifices and the selfless work that they did throughout their time in their service.
And you know, Fran, I think what Patrick just said kind of encapsulates the entire message of the book, because no surrender, and this is what I realized very early on in the process, was not going to be a typical book by a special operator. In other words, it wasn't going to be an operational, mission-oriented book where we get taken into foxholes, if it was an older book, or we're seeing the world through night vision goggles and there's a nighttime raid to rescue hostages. That's not what this book is. It was never what this book was intended to be. And for people who want those kind of books, no, that's not what No Surrender is, but there are plenty of books that are. We do get to Iraq, but it is not the focal point. What happens in Iraq is not the focal point of the story. The focal point of the story is actually something that I think Patrick summed up really well in a recent interview he did with the Huffington Post. When he talks about the SEAL at ethos. And there's a reason why SEALs have become, you know, I was on a SEAL website the other night and I was looking at high school teams that come to Coronado and they train for a day. They do some very little of the stuff, some of the stuff that not actually right out of Bud's training, but some of the exercises and some of the drills and some of that. And former Navy SEALs are all over the country speaking to football teams and in corporate environments about success and about how to be better than you are tomorrow than how you are today, and how to be better in the next hour than you are in the current minute. And the reason for that, I think, what is in everything Patrick is saying about his experiences that we relate in No Surrender are those is that application of how the SEAL ethos, the SEAL, the principles of what the SEALs stand for can be applied to everyday life of people like you and I, and how the lessons that come out of this story are things that we can apply to our everyday lives. And there's something very interesting about this book that there's never been anything even close to something that I've been involved with before, and something that I really didn't think was going to work initially, and that is at the end of every chapter, there are lessons, what I learned from this, which was actually then changed to what you can learn from this, from what Patrick is relating, three or four bullet points of what you can take. Now, initially, I didn't think that would work because that's not something I'd ever done before. But in this case, I look at it now and I can't picture the book without those tags at the end of each chapter, because they kind of bring it. Patrick, why don't you comment on that?
Well,
because
I just wanted John to know, like, what I wanted the reader or the audience to see and to get from it. Like, I didn't want to tell a story. I didn't want to say this is what I did and this is how I operated and I am a Navy SEAL. Like, I didn't want that to be the focal point of the book. I'm not trying to sell being a SEAL or sell the Trident or anything like that. I'm simply giving everyone an inside look to my life and an inside look to how that time in my career changed me. And then with the lessons learned, I mean, that's a common theme throughout life in general. And I told John, I was like, this is what I want, because I need people to get my message in the right way. And so, you know, John, being who he is, very strong-willed and strong-minded, he said, he was like, no, he wanted to stay away from that, right? And the more we got into it, the more he saw what I was trying to do, the more he saw the message of the book, because what he wanted and what I wanted initially were completely the opposite. But I finally dug in. I did not give up. I did not surrender. And
I did.
And he saw it.
I have to agree with you. I have to agree with you 100%, because as an educator, you always learn from something, and I learned a lot from reading your tags. And I think that that's what made I alluded to them in my review, by the way. I did put down that you put lessons to learn, and I did quote some of them, and I hope nobody minds. But I'm going to say this one is really one of the ones that stood out in my mind. Quitting is not worth it. All that hard work for what? Just to prove others right about me? No, thank you. I have to tell you that I've used that in my head so many times in the last couple of months for a lot of different reasons. And the other one is, I must not lose focus on my goals, both short-term and long. If I don't break my focus, I will win. And I so agree with you. John, it's a good thing you let him do it his way. Seriously.
Well, you know, it's the other example of that was, you know, as I said, as I alluded to before, there is a very strong faith-based message in this book. And I was worried initially. One of the things I wanted to do was make it was kind of cast a wider net and make it more of a standard exercise in narrative nonfiction, where it would reach a potentially larger audience. I'm thinking in terms of, you know, who's of buyers and who's walking through a bookstore. But any book, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, has something as it's going to take you in the direction it needs to be. Story is everything. Now, in the case of fiction, it's something that's happening in my imagination. In this case, the story is Patrick's life, and it needs to be organic. It needs to be what it's supposed to be. And I think by working together and listening and reading both the lines and between the lines, what this book became is what it needed to be, in the same way that when I write fiction, I go with my instincts, I go with my gut, I go with where the characters take me, not necessarily where I thought I was going. In this case, I went with where Patrick was taking me and where his story was taking me, instead of trying to resist that impulse to impose my own will, my own sense of storytelling onto something that was real. The great thing about this book is it's not embellished. I mean, it is what it is. It's the story of all these tales, and one of them that Patrick didn't refer to. People are going to read this book and they say that's impossible. It never happens. But you were asking about Coach, his basketball coach, and Coach Ingles. You know, they had come to, really loggerheads. And at one point, Patrick said to him, I wish you were dead. How many times
do we say
that to people?
I remember that.
Or do we actually?
I know.
Well, the next day, Patrick comes into school, and the guy.
Well, I want to intervene here. It's like I carried that with me for such a long time.
Yeah.
And, I mean, my tongue can lash out like a whip in a matter of microseconds, it feels like. And I just wish that I could have been a little bit older and a little bit wiser and refrained from saying the things that can hurt others and hurt yourself ultimately. I just wanted to throw that in there. But if they haven't read the book already, I didn't want to give anything away either.
I might have given too much away with that one. And it's true. It's just that we say these things all the time, and I've never heard of it actually happening before. And it was, it goes to, you can't make, there was so much, and here's the point I wanted to get at. There was so much story already there. You know, I talked about embellishing. I've done other nonfiction books where, I've taken some creative liberties, as often happens in nonfiction. Here, that wasn't necessary, and that's the point I wanted to get to. Here, the story spoke for itself, and it needed to be what Patrick wanted it to be. And I'll say, Fran, that, this is, I think, my 42nd book that's published. Of course, it's a written-with book. I'm the second banana. But the fact is that I'm as proud or more proud of this book than anything else I've ever done.
This book is more than great. It's a great accomplishment. It's fantastic. And definitely it teaches people. So I'm going to read the end of the epilogue in just a moment. But before I forget, on August 1st is when this girl is going to return. Yeah, you can't get rid of me. And I'm going to be interviewing Bruce Kerwin, 66 Metra. Interesting story. He's coming from France. On 8:10, Gary Grossman, Executive Action. 8:15, I'm not sure if he's going to be at the Thriller Fest. David Bell, Bring Her Home. I happened to see that, and I just happened to get lucky and got it. At 8:17, another memoir, true story, Rachel Hosk, LCSW, to fly again. It's a true story of her son who was bipolar and committed suicide, and she hopes that it'll help other people to understand how that's supposed to be diagnosed. So on the last page of the book, this just proves the book is in front of me. I know that you can stand up, be strong, and stand firm against the tides of life when the waves crash down on you by believing in yourself even when no one else does. You can, you will. Remember, no surrender. How come you decided to end the book like that? That was so perfect. Seriously.
Why did I decide to do it that way?
Why did you guys decide to end it with those particular words? I cried when I read that. Seriously.
Well, okay, then I did what I was supposed to do. I got you to think about life and to think about what is possible and to dream, but then to act on those dreams. Don't just dream, but to put that into action. And no matter what happens to you in your life, no matter what gets thrown at you, you know, the tides of life just keep crashing down and crashing down. And pretty soon, if you give up, you're just going to be thrown to the shorelines. But if you keep pressing forward, after those waves come crashing, you get farther out,
mm-hmm.
you push farther than anybody else has ever pushed before in their life. You get through those waves, you get through those tides, and you can see the open waters, and you're able to move forward without those waves. You're just in it, and you're free, and the sky's the limit. You can do whatever you want, and you're able to succeed at life only if you do not give up.
I wish you would speak to high school students, seriously, because I think they need that kind of support and that kind of encouragement, because especially the ones that are thinking about quitting or dropping out or are not doing what they're supposed to do. I think the coming to speak with them and hearing your story and what you've done might be an inspiration for them, besides college students in sports, seriously. I think everyone needs to hear this.
I have spoken to quite a few people, and I'm doing another event at a college at Michigan State University in a few months. Mm-hmm. But I'm always open to speak to whoever has an open ear and is willing to listen, or at least who will have me, because I think as long as you mm-hmm. don't think that you know it all, or that you have an open ear, at least for a little bit, that you can take something from anyone who speaks to you. It doesn't have to be me or anyone else. You know? So as long as you have an open ear, you can gain something from it.
I agree with you. So if you could tell anyone in your life what they mean to you right now, who would you say was the one person that helped you overcome the most challenges?
Ooh. Well, that would have to be Jesus. He's the one.
Okay.
He's the only one. He is the way, he's the truth, and he's the life. And I wouldn't have been nothing without him. I could accomplish many things,
mm-hmm.
but I did not find my sole purpose until I gave myself up to him. And that
mm-hmm.
is the most powerful thing in my life. Now, I could be anything and I could do anything, but I would still
mm-hmm.
have an emptiness or a longing, and I'd be searching for that one thing, like, what is it that I'm trying to find? And once I found that personal relationship with him, more doors opened up, and credit to my wife for helping me find that true path. Without her, I would definitely be lost out at sea without her. So there's two.
Mm-hmm.
There's, those two are the most influential people in my life that changed me for the better.
That's amazing. So before we go, John, how did writing this book with Patrick help you get to know him better? And Patrick, what did you learn? And what did you learn about John from writing this book with him? And is there going to be a sequel? Seriously, it sounds like you have a lot more to say. I always do that to
well,
John
I've
all
learned,
the time.
I love doing that. This is Patrick, and I did learn a lot from John. I learned the business
mm-hmm.
side of things. I learned the book and the process, and when I think that I'm done and I have a good product, or I have completed something, you're really only about halfway there or less than. So I learned a lot from him, and I learned that you can always get help from many other people. And he is a true writer in all the sense. He's on top of things, very professional, and always willing to take the call and always willing to listen and always willing to fix the story or hear my critique, even though at first he was like, no one's ever said this to me like this. No one's ever confronted me like this.
I remember that.
So,
uh-oh.
I did learn a lot from him.
You know, Fran, the job mm-hmm. of the writer in telling a story is to find the voice of his or her characters. In fiction,
exactly.
You're trying to make your characters sound real. The job in nonfiction is to do the opposite. It's to find the voice of the subject, of the first of the person telling the story in first person, because all the nonfiction I do mm-hmm. is first person. You help that writer find his voice and find his cadence and find his rhythm. And in that sense, you're making him sound almost like a fictional character. So it's the opposite job that you have. And the great fun and challenge of No Surrender for me was the other nonfiction books I had done were all they were all straight narratives. They were more or less they were true crime books. They were, you know, they had really happened, and there were gunfights, and there were, you know, there was subplots. It was just like basically a nonfiction novel, to quote Truman Capote. This was much different for me because it was message, because it's message based. It has a theme. It has a purpose. But where Patrick's voice, where I had the most fun bringing out Patrick's voice to your question and to your point, was
mm-hmm.
there's so much. This is, although it's message based, it's incident and episode driven. And you've heard a few stories of things that we allude to in the book, maybe giving away a few too many things, which unfortunately is my nature. What can I do? You know, the spoiler
mine too.
Alert, right? Yeah. So, but the idea that we're presenting a message in terms of incident, not in terms of just a character, in this case a real person speaking, but illustrating their experiences through the incidents that they've had in their life. So in that sense,
mm-hmm.
my responsibility was helping Patrick find his voice amid telling a message-based story that derives from all his experiences, putting it into a coherent, cognizant format that when people read it, they get it. And you know, it's such a great, you know, the book's been out, it has been only been out 6 days now. It was published on 4th of July. And the response of people who are reading it and who are getting it is really profound. And it makes me
it's
feel...
It's been tweeted all over the place, John, everywhere. I mean, everybody's been twittering my review, but a lot of people are reading it on my Just Reviews. I'm getting a lot of comments, positive comments. So obviously... this is good. But I have to say, first of all, I have to thank John a million times for doing a blurb for my book that's coming out at the end of the month. Yay! A Daughter's Promise. And it's a true story told in my voice and my mother's voice. Before my mother died, when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I kept a journal of everything she said. And she was going to occupational therapy, and she made me go with her. And she wouldn't do the homework. She made me do it for her. She dictated because she didn't want to write. It wasn't that she couldn't, she just didn't feel like it. So all the words in the book and everything are all true, and I thank you because I'm really excited. They added a preface about Alzheimer's, and they added I had to edit some other things at the end of the book so that everybody would know what Coumadin is and everything. So I'm excited about that, and I will mail you a copy as soon as I get one. I'm thrilled. So, John, where can we learn about more about getting this book and getting more copies, more about your work, and everybody? I just read Dark Gone Light, and John wrote his first horror. And boy, it's a horror. It's really good. It's scary, too. And, yeah, I can't wait to talk about that one. So where can we learn about both of you and your work?
Well, about the book and just sticking with No Surrender, there's a lot starting to appear on the Internet. I haven't done as good a job as I should about keeping up my website. But I think my Facebook page, just go to John Land on Facebook, or any of the, we're constantly updating the reviews on Amazon, on Goodreads. And if you want to know what a book is, you go to an author's website, you're only going to see what they want you to see. So to me, go to Goodreads and go to Amazon and go to the other book pages that have a collection of what readers have said. Of what, or you know, when you Google it, you know, pick your own reviews to see, and that way you're not getting what I want you to see. You're getting what's out there, and that's what I would recommend people do because this book America's No Surrender really stands on its own and doesn't need me pumping it on my website.
Well, you know what? You could go to my review site, Just Reviews on WordPress, which is Tilly29 at WordPress.com. And you can read my review, everybody, because it's really good. You can go to Goodreads. You can go everybody. But you have, there's a difference between a review that where the person actually read the book and then the review that says, oh, the book's great, and that doesn't say very much of anything. You want one with substance, so feel free to read whatever I write. I don't care. That would be great. So thank you so much.
So how
much.
Do they find Patrick?
Yeah.
How do people find Patrick?
Patrick, how
well,
do we find you,
find
and how
me.
Do we know more about you? Are you going to write another one so I can read it?
I think I'll have to live another 30 years to write another book. Another 33 years to write another book.
Oh, I don't know about that, but you can write about your training, you know, training people to be Navy SEALs, or just, you know, just courage in general. You can figure something out. I'm sure John will figure it out with you.
Well,
you
I appreciate that. Thank you for the kind words. And if you're looking to connect with me, you can find me on LinkedIn, just first and last name. You can find me at Twitter at my first and last name, or if you're trying to email me and want me to come and speak at an event or anything like that, then it's just Beischer Consulting LLC at Gmail. And
that is so interesting. And there's a lot. Are you going to be at the Villa Fest this week?
I will not be able to make it. I have other priorities that I need to fulfill, but I did want to go because it was a good learning experience last time, and I enjoyed
mm-hmm.
the panel, and I really enjoyed the questions that people had there. I'll miss it.
I love it also, and I learn a lot, and I'm going to take my pen and pencil this year so I can learn an awful lot more about writing in first person like John, and so someday one of you guys will do something on dialogue so I can learn how to write better dialogue, because that's my other not strong suit. So, John, when is the next book coming out in the Caitlin Strong series? Hope so.
December 5th, Strong to the Bone.
December 5th.
Just like Patrick.
Strong to. I want you to know on my WordPress site, 5 people just read my review that I did over a year ago on several other of your book. Everybody's reading them.
Uh-huh.
So you must be really getting popular here. Yeah, this is great. So December 5th, Strong to the Bone. And the other one is coming out August 1st. And I sent you an email with dates, so you can tell me when you want to do the review or interview
mm-hmm.
For this mm-hmm. one, for the new one, which, of course, I read and got total eye strain because I couldn't put it down. And if Fabrizio comes on the show with you, that would really be cool. That would really be good.
Yes.
So I want to thank
yes.
you both, and thank you so much. And I will be there on Friday, and I can't wait to go to the Thriller Fest and see everybody. And, of course, I can't wait to see John. And, Patrick, thank you so much for today. This means a lot to everyone. And, everyone, the sun is shining out there. It's not raining yet. Have a great day. And thank you, John. Thank you, Patrick. And bye.
Thank you, friend.
Bye.
Patrick, did you have a good time?
Yes.
I think it went really well. I think we make a great team.
Good.
You know?
I'm glad you think so.
Yes, yeah. I do.
Okay. So where is this, where's her review thing? Where is that at?
You don't want to know. I'd say the one you don't like on Amazon, that's friends.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah, it's the one. She gives a lot away, but she does it to – she's so passionate, and she has so many fans, so many people who read her stuff, and it's like she's just the nicest person, you know, and she loves books, and she actually reads them. You know, I get interviewed a lot by people who have no idea. They'll read the acknowledgments page and ask me about the acknowledgments page. That's fine. So
right.
I think that went really well. I keep checking my emails to see if we've heard anything from Devin. You know, and I'll get this I'll find out where the link is. I think it's up on her Facebook page, and send it out to Anthony and Devin, and they can circulate it. And I'll also, once I get it, I'll tweet it out so people can listen. By the way, you're going to see a new thing on Twitter today. It's going to run at 6 o'clock every night, and it's the No Surrender quote of the day. And it's a quote from either the book or an interview that you've done, you know, the Huffington Post I'm pulling a lot of. And all that's all it is. It's just a quote. And what I've started to do a little bit is instead of just like you can't fit a lot in Twitter as far as quotes go. So I kind of just blow it up and screen save it and then paste it in. So sometimes I do that. So we're going to see, instead of just quoting reviews and accolades, it's going to be the No Surrender quote of the day. So if you have any you want me to use, just send them on. I can pull them from the book too. I can pull paragraphs from the book just without giving any spoiler alerts, but I don't want to give anything away. I'd like to do, but I'm just trying to figure out something different that people will more likely to share. So the No Surrender quote of the day, hopefully it works.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, Twitter is not as big as Facebook. I mean, you, like you said, you can only fit 120 characters in there or whatever. And that's more like up to date, like now, like what's going on. That's like the people that are always by their phones and whatnot. But I think Facebook is a bigger general audience that will see that. So are you, I kind of like blanked out for a minute trying to figure out, are you going to do both?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think Twitter, I think this, the No Surrender quote of the day is catered better for Twitter. I think one of the things I want to talk to Anthony about is Facebook ads. Seeing if I want to talk
like
to him.
That,
you know,
that would really, really help. I mean, I got a couple of friends have that run their books on there, like a couple other SEALs, like who I know well, Mike Ritland, and he's like the Navy SEAL Dogs author, and then he wrote another book, and he has his stuff on there, and it gets a ton of feedback, like crazy amounts, you know, like thousands, 2,000 people will like it or comment or whatever, you know, and it's just, I think it's
no,
very
it is. If you target it properly, and I'm just starting to look into this, I've got an author friend I'm going to see, Kent Lester, up in New York this week, and he's got it. He's figured out all the metrics of how you target in a Facebook ad, a campaign.
Yeah.
Who your ad is going to be seen by? It's a very cost effective thing for. You get so much bang for the buck with Facebook ads. So. That's one of the things I'm going to talk to Anthony about, and I'm going to talk to him about the Rogers and Cowan thing too. So, you know, if you now that the holiday season is over, they're probably back in the office. So maybe if you want to have that conversation with them, where they put a proposal together of what they think they can do, you know, for the book, you know, for that in that same price range that they helped out Remy, you know, this is the time to do it. We'll present it and we'll see if we can. You know, if we get Fox and Friends, we have a very strong argument to make. And if we don't, we still have a strong argument to make. And I think we will get Fox and Friends because they said they were very interested. It just that last week became crazy. And everybody's out of the office. And, you know, they're spending a lot of their time because of the time difference. They're covering they were covering the G20 live at times because, you know, they were in Germany. So it turned out not to be a great week. You know, to try to get on any of these shows. So hopefully this week's a little better, and we'll see if we hear back from Devin. I'll reach out to her this morning as soon as I got a couple other things I got to do, and then I'll reach out to her and get an update. And I'll reach out to Anthony about seeing him on Wednesday and congratulate him again on the new baby.
Right, that's awesome.
Yeah, he's a proud daddy. Born, I think she was. And born right on time, just like 6 days early, which isn't bad at all. So, so he'll be in a good mood when I'll see him Wednesday.
Okay.
If he hasn't lost his mind already.
He probably will be very tired.
All right. Did I read somewhere, is Nikki pregnant? Did I see that?
Oh, yeah. She's like 6 months pregnant.
Yeah, I didn't know you were having another kid.
Yeah.
I'm learning. See, I got to learn things on social media now, you know, or an email. I mean, you know, it's like, oh, okay. I didn't know that.
I thought I told you.
I don't.
Sure
you may have, and I just ignored it.
Yeah.
That could very well be.
Accurate.
Yeah, that's probably. Oh, that's probably the case. All right, so we'll catch up soon, and I think you did. That was really a great interview.
Cool.
All right.
I look forward to more.
Absolutely.
If there are any.
Yeah, there will be. And anything, you know, even I leave for New York tomorrow, but obviously available by email and cell phone.
All right. Talk to you later.
Be well. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.